So, please, let's start with calling the meeting to order. The meeting will now come to order. And we'll start with the Pledge of Allegiance, so please join me.
I pledge allegiance to the flag of the United States of America and to the republic for which it stands, one nation, under God, indivisible, with liberty and justice for all.
Thank you. Please be seated. Okay. We have our quorum. Everyone is here. Very nice. And I think we'll start then with item two under special reports. And we'll hear first from Commander Taylor on the Sheriff's Report. Welcome.
Good afternoon. For today's report, last month you had asked about getting some information from last year to kind of compare and contrast where we were. So I'm going to go down this month's report, but I'm going to kind of reference where we were last month. I pulled a report that I gave to you last year that covered the period of September 16th through October 21st of 2015. For this period, September 22nd through today, there were 335 calls for service in Cambria. For the same period last year, we had received 322 calls, so fairly stable in terms of those numbers. For this month, we had 35 traffic stops by deputies. Last year, we had 38 traffic stops. We had 9 pedestrian contacts this month. The same time last year, we had 7. There were 16 alarm calls this month for both audible and motion sensor alarms. For last month, there were 3. When I started checking on the dates, it seemed that a large number of them had occurred during the rainstorm that had blown through earlier in the month. We had 25 incomplete 911 calls this month that required that deputies respond. Last year, for this roughly the same period, we had 48 911 calls. This month, we had 15 disturbing the peace calls. They ranged from loud music to neighborhood disputes. For the same period last year, we had 23, so there's a decrease in the disturbing calls. We had 4 vandalism reports this month. These included vandalism to district-owned fencing out at the Sustainable Water Facility, vandalism to a district-owned bathroom facility in the 1,000 block of Main Street. We had a vandalism to a scarecrow at Timpson and Main, and we had damage to a cement bench at St. Paul's Church. So we had 4 vandalism reports. Last year, for the same period, we had 3. We had 14 theft reports. Now, 8 of these were from unlocked cars in the area of Weymouth Drive, Iva Court, and Newton Road. They occurred between the 25th of September and the 29th. On October 1st, our deputies arrested a local male transient for violation of probation after he had tried to evade them late at night in the area of Center Street and Hesperian Lane. While this person was in custody, we didn't receive any theft reports from unlocked cars. 5 days after he was released from custody, we had 3 more thefts from unlocked cars in the area of Weymouth, McCabe, and Drayden Avenue. So we're currently looking for him as a person of interest, to say, to find out if he might have been connected. The remaining thefts included a bicycle from in front of a residence on Andover, theft of a cable box from a residence on Wood Drive. The tenant was in the process of moving out. And then there was a report of theft of money from a cash register by an employee at a local business. So we had 14 theft reports. In the previous period, last year, we had 4. We had 4 burglaries during this month. Last year, we had 3 burglaries for the same period. So it's fairly consistent. The burglaries this month were to a residence at 2100 block of Orme Place. The tenant was moving out, and items disappeared from the house while it was open, and they weren't present. We had a burglary to a vehicle that was parked inside a locked garage in the 3100 block of Rogers Drive. That occurred on the 29th of September. We had the burglary of a camper shell which was on the back of a pickup truck parked in the 1700 block of Stewart, and that occurred on September 30th. We had an attempted burglary to a residence in the 300 block of Huntington. In that case, the burglary was reported by a neighbor as it was happening. Deputies responded. They were assisted by state park rangers. All of them arrived on scene, and they caught the suspect, who was a 17-year-old male juvenile. He was arrested for attempted burglary and possession of methamphetamine. This last incident, I think, underscores the importance of the Neighborhood Watch program. I know that our crime prevention specialists have been up recently meeting with people who wanted to set up Neighborhood Watch, and I think, I don't know that it was a Neighborhood Watch that necessarily caught this, but it underscores the importance of looking out for each other in our neighborhoods and kind of paying attention to what's going on. We had 11 arrests this month. For the same reporting period last year, there were 12 arrests. The arrests consisted of 5 warrants, 2 public intoxication arrests, 2 probation violation. We arrested a subject who was in possession of prescription medications and a pair of nunchucks, which are illegal. And we had one burglary arrest, which was the juvenile that we talked about. So essentially, the calls for service have been consistent from last year to this year. There has been the increase in the thefts, and again, that seems to be a recurring problem throughout the coastal area. All the communities that I run reports for are seeing thefts, and primarily from unlocked cars. They're easy targets, and it's an increase that we're seeing statewide in property crime. So it's not anything that's unusual for Cambria itself, and that's the report.
Thank you very much. It is interesting. We always come back to this thing of locking your car. Mm-hmm. Just good common sense advice. So we'll continue with that. And I really appreciated the comparative report. Mm-hmm. And from time to time, if you can do that,
sure,
it gives us an idea. And at times when we don't have that, we think, wow, things are sounding like they're really up there and getting mm-hmm. active, when in reality, it wasn't so far off,
right.
Similar types of things. And I'm very impressed with the fact that you were able to catch the burglary in progress on Huntington, to have both state parks, you said, and the sheriff there, because, you know, sometimes a response call, it just depends, I know, but
right.
that was really fortunate. So are there any other comments or questions? Vice President Thompson?
Yes, Commander Taylor. With respect to the vandalism at the district's sustainable water facility, because it involved vandalism at the community's water supply facility, is that just a misdemeanor, or is that potentially a higher grade felony?
Well, if it's just the cutting of the fence, it would fall under the category of the misdemeanor. There wasn't any evidence that I was made aware of that there was anything beyond that. I think General Manager Gruber is going to talk about it more in depth, but it's probably worth keeping an eye on. It may even be worth using cameras to kind of keep an eye on that section of the fence. I know that the investigator that is taking the report is our rural crimes deputy, and he has available cameras and various equipment to kind of monitor it if we feel that it's needed. This is going to be an ongoing problem.
I'll comment on that, too. I think any time someone's actually creating a crime to get into the water system mm-hmm. for all of us in this community, I would really, if it were at all possible, for sure have cameras.
Okay.
Thank you.
Good. Very good.
Yes, Kathy?
I just wanted to add something. Can mm-hmm. I share your mic here?
Sure.
I'm Kathy Tanner with the Cambrian. I just wanted to let you know that in our sheriff's log that we run every week, we have expanded that, and each week we are now listing, as we have in the past for years, the calls that and the arrests that have happened that week. We list the arrests, we enumerate the number of calls, but we are also doing a comparative of the week from the year before.
Perfect. That's perfect. Great. We really appreciate that, too. Thank you very much. I think the more we're on top of things, the more proactive we can be in
right.
the future. So thank you. No other comments?
Yeah, one question.
Yes, sir.
If I may. Commander Taylor, have the patrols, the additional patrols from the Coast substation been implemented yet?
The second graveyard car has not. We have seven deputies currently on field training that have been hired, and we're ongoing hiring, filling the other positions. If we hire someone laterally, which is what we try to do to control the costs of recruitment, they still end up having to go to a between 14 and 16 week field training program. When we hire a deputy either out of our jail, promote someone to the rank of deputy sheriff, or if we hire someone off the street, it's a 30 week police academy, and it's a 26 week field training program. So we're trying to get as many lateral candidates. Unfortunately, we've been successful to right now, but to answer your question about the second graveyard car, I don't envision that it'll happen before the end of the year, because that's about the time all these new candidates will get off of training, and I'll get at least two more bodies at my station, if not more.
Okay. Can you give us an update after the first of the year?
Yes.
Thank you.
Thank you very much. Always nice to see you, Commander. Next, then, on special reports, we have a report from Chief Hollingsworth on activities with our Cambria Fire Department. Welcome.
Good afternoon. I feel a little bit disjointed because I'm about 3 hours later than I would normally be doing this with you, but I'm sure you all feel the same way. So.
Just thank you. That's true.
Does it show? I didn't say out of sorts. That would be different. For the reporting for the month of September, there were 63 emergency incidents the fire department responded to. Of those, 42 of them, roughly 67%, were EMS related. That tends to be following the norm, anywhere from 65 to 75%, which then further justifies maintaining the ALS component and why we pursued that original grant we did. So we're still able to deliver that service to the community, and very grateful that we're able to do so. We had two vehicle TCs. We did have one structure fire with very minor damage. And then of particular interest in regards to responses, we had two auto aid vehicle TCs, and that's where we respond in to other areas, either San Simeon or farther south towards Cayucas, to help out CAL FIRE with their response because of the size of the incident, number of patients, or other mitigating factors. But that is fairly typical in response as well. Of note, in September, there were 35 specific prevention various contacts that we made from the station with the community. Those vary in cause from rough-in inspections, final inspections. These are all building-related type things. A lot of them are fire plan reviews, either for very minor remodels, like a deck change, siding change, things like that, that still has to comply with the fire code, to full-on evaluation of a new building project. One of the things that we do offer in this community is help. The average age in this town is 59.2 years old, and so there's a lot of people that just cannot physically change the batteries in their smoke detectors. And so about every two or three days, we get phone calls to come out and do that, and it might be one in a home, it might be a large home with six or seven. And so that happens on a fairly regular basis. And then also in regards to prevention areas, the fire hazard fear reduction program drew to a close in the month of September, and all of the contract work was finalized, and that information was turned over to Pat O'Reilly, and the billing for that will be going out within the next few weeks, if not already has done so. I'm looking at Monique as if she knows. She might. I'm not sure. I know it's been completed and is being turned around. And then of interest of what's happening right now, I will report on it in more detail next month. We're finalizing an exhaustive swimmer boat rescue class right now that's a week long. The majority of the people in this class, although we're hosting it here, are from Cambria Fire. And one of the main reasons behind that and why we committed so much money from our training budget to do so is that NCOR has historically relied heavily on volunteerism to staff that. And although there are still people in the community that are very vested in interest, their availability is declining. And it's very difficult for our crews to go out and respond to an incident and without that training basically sit on the cliff and watch. And that's something that anybody in emergency services just has a hard time doing. So we kind of made a philosophical change within the department in making that a major functional component of everybody that's there. So ideally, you're going to have two, if not four, people on every single day that have the ability and training to be either rescue swimmers or in the boat, and that's what's happening this week. So I'm real happy about that. We're going to be doing another one of those classes at probably the beginning of this next year and capture the few people we missed, but it, again, will be open and be drawing other participants from around the state, just like this one did as well. So that's all I have for you right
Thank
now.
Thank you. Very, very excellent. How will this... The ocean rescue. Will you coordinate with NCOR or
absolutely? NCOR is still going to exist as the functional component of how that's organized. Right now, all the members of the department that are being trained in that capacity will become members of NCOR. But what's happened in recent months, in the last probably 6 months, there has been three specific incidents that have kind of pushed us in this regard, wherein the rescues were actually affected by people that happened to be on duty, that happened to have the training, and they were able to do that, and no members of NCORD showed up. And so if they didn't show up and our personnel were not trained to do so, we would have been waiting from a rescue team from possibly Avila Beach area. And so that's unacceptable in my mind.
I think it's an excellent idea because certainly we do have calls. I know we were at a veterans ceremonial thing not so long ago, and there was an event during that that took place, a rescue. So I think certainly having people on duty, having NCOR as a support to you and help when they can is really important, but having people on duty to get there fast is life-saving, is invaluable.
Absolutely.
Thank you very much.
Yes, ma'am.
And we have a couple of, let's see, Vice President Thompson.
Just a follow-up. Would it be helpful if we did launch more of a recruitment for locals to participate in NCOR? And because I don't know if, well, the folks that were on it before are getting up there in age and so forth.
Getting up where?
We have done that periodically. A lot of the volunteerism aspect of the organization has been spread word of mouth. And so the people that originally helped out, like when we developed NCOR, a lot of this started from Captain Bitto, as you well know, back in 1995. And I happened to be in the very first training class along with him when we purchased the boats and developed NCOR. And he was seminal in making that happen. And there was about a 50-50 split between people that were career full-time, either with the ambulance or fire department, and then true volunteers from the community that were surfers, fishermen, just avid watermen. And then through time, a lot of the people that were work-related ended up letting it go because there were other avenues that they needed to pursue, whether that was paramedicine or hazmat specialties, moving on to different areas, which is simply losing people to other agencies. And so everything was really being staffed by volunteers throughout the last number of years. And that is now declining. And so yes, there would be value. We could probably do some kind of recruitment within the community. But along with that, there's now paired a standard of training and service. And so gone are the days that you could just show up and they'll hand you a pager and say you're going to be part of the team. You're going to have to meet the same standard that everybody else does. But we would absolutely, and some of the people, in fact, one of the people in the class right now is a volunteer from the community.
Great. Thank you, Chief.
Excellent. Any other comments for the chief? All right. Well, thank you. We're going to see you again later. Okay. We are now moving into item three, acknowledgments and presentations. And General Manager Gruber, would you like to introduce Mr. Cliff, our first presenter?
Thank you, Madam President. And you're going to need to go up to the podium for this, and it's good to see Merle back here. But item 3A is Merle Cliff to present the CCSD with a President's Special Acknowledgement Award from the SDRMA to recognize there were no paid claims during the prior five consecutive years in property liability programs. Thank you.
And are you going to join me?
Would you like me to join you?
Yes.
Okay, I'll join you.
I don't get to give a big speech ahead of time. No, come on. For the record, my name is Merle Clift. I'm a Cambria resident, but I'm here today to represent the Special District Risk Management Authority from Sacramento. The Special District Risk Management Authority is a joint powers agency composed of a little over 720 special districts and small governmental agencies, the purpose of which is to combine resources so that the members have access to property and liability insurance, workers' comp insurance, education, and risk management services. I'm actually here for two reasons. One reason is 30 years ago, a group of 56 special districts met in Sacramento to deal with what at that point in time was a problem of the increasing costs of commercial insurance. They decided to form what ultimately became Special District Risk Management Authority to provide benefits to its members. I am very proud to say that the Cambria Community Service District is a founding member of that group. The foresight of the board at that time to participate was great, and the fact of the matter is you've been a participating member for the past 30 years. That reflects in the longevity bonus. As a member of the association, you're an owner and entitled to a share of the excess earnings, and that reflects to in your longevity bonus that is issued each year. And the length of time you've been in the program is one of the factors in that decision. So on behalf of President Aranda and the members of the board, we want to thank you for being an originating member and for your continuing support. So that's one item. Second item is that each year we designate districts that have a five-year experience of no claims. That's extremely important because, again, remember back, you're an owner of this organization. It's not the success of it, the fact that premiums have stayed level for at least the last 4 years is a factor in your management and your employees' ability to be safe, to treat the public in such a way as you don't get sued as often, and use all of the safety, education, and educational aspects, which you do. Your general manager has promoted the safety and programs that are available through SDRMA. Your employees have taken advantage of it. It's been a net result for you in that you did not have to send people out to be trained at some other location or something. So on behalf of the Board of Directors of SDRMA, I want to present the President's Special Acknowledgement Award. It says, hereby gives special recognition to Cambria Community Service District. The President's Special Knowledge Award has recognized members who have no paid claims during the prior five consecutive years in the Property and Liability Program. So, recognizing your efforts, we want to thank you. I love giving you a hard time.
I know you do. Yeah. Well, I enjoy receiving it, at least most of the time.
Well, I would say this, first of all, to you, Merle, it is wonderful always to see you here. And I wanted to ask one question, too. On this type of award that comes to a special service district, is the track record of 5 years and no claims, is that a pretty unusual event?
It's above average. Quite frankly, the members are very, very, are becoming more and more conscious of the liabilities and property claims and It's more and more are reaching this goal, but you're in the top half.
That is excellent. Well, on behalf of the board, I accept this, and I find it is quite a credit, of course, to the employees, to the leadership, to General Manager Gruber, and this will look and have a very special place in the office for everyone to know. So good. Thank you again. Appreciate it. Yes, that very nice, very nice. Next on presentations, we have next. Wow, look at Mr. Mendoza. We have Carlos Mendoza, of course, our facilities and resource supervisor, and he is going to provide a presentation on the Fiscalini Ranch Preserve Phase 1 park improvement, something that's been in the works since I know Vice President Thompson and I were on PROS too, so we're really glad to see this really coming to fruition. So, Carlos, welcome.
Thank you.
And Madam President, just real quick, I wanted to recognize Steve Niffen, who is the chair of our PROS commission. He is here also, and I just
want to... Where is he?
Publicly, he's slunched down in the back
there he is.
But I just wanted to acknowledge his... And just real quick, this is a continuation of the special PROS meeting we had on Tuesday of this week, and so I'll let Carlos explain where we are in the process, and maybe Steve would like to, if it's okay with Madam President and the board, for that Mr. Niffen could come up maybe and add a little bit to it.
Yeah, I think that would be great. And while we're recognizing Fiscalini Ranch Preserve, we also have the executive director, of course, here with us this afternoon too.
I didn't see her.
Jo Ellen is here. Jo Ellen Butler.
Oh.
And so we may hear from both Jo Ellen and Steve, but Carlos, this is your presentation, so we welcome you and let you start the presentation. Thank you very much.
Thank you. I appreciate the opportunity to be here and provide an update on the community park. I think it's important to maybe just go over a brief history of how we came about with the community park, talk about the Phase 1 plan, and also where we are at this point. The community park actually has been in the works for over 20 years. Back in... Not working yet.
With a little technical assistance requested here.
A little bit.
Yeah, that's better. Yeah. Yeah, we'll give you a moment and it'll come together. In the meantime, it's looking pretty rainy out there today, isn't it? Pretty exciting. That's fast.
There we are.
Okay.
All right, no worries. If we can do the next slide, that'd be great.
Just say next slide, I think, if whenever you're ready.
I think it froze back there on the computer.
We could take a short break here. Let's take... Yeah, let's take a little break, and I want to... People can get coffee. We'll give them a minute, but...
There it is.
Okay.
There we are.
Thank you.
As I was mentioning, the community park has been in the plans for over 20 years. In fact, in 1994, the community park was included as the in the Parks, Recreation, and Open Space Master Plan. And next slide. One of the major milestones came in 2000.
Next. We need to revisit.
Oh, okay. All right.
That was just a quick little nice break, and so we are ready to go. So I'm going to ask you to go ahead and come back and join us and take your seats, please. Okay. All right. So, Carlos, you've had your introduction. With this now, we are ready to see what's going on. So thank you very much.
No problem. As I was mentioning, one of the major milestones for the community park came about in 2000 when the Fiscalini Ranch was purchased, and a section of the ranch was dedicated for the construction of the community park. And as you can see in the picture, a portion of the east area of the Fiscalini Ranch was designated for that. It's at the end of Rodeo Grounds Road. In 2003, the district hire RRM design group, and along with PROS, there was a lot of community meetings, a lot of community input on what the community park should have, and a conceptual master plan was developed from those meetings. In 2009, the final environmental impact report was prepared for the Fiscalini Ranch, And during that process, the community park was revisited. There was a lot of community input, a lot of community meetings. And the park design was revised from the 2003 concept. It reduced it in size. And what came about was this design here that you see on the screen. So what amenities does the community park have? Well, the community park includes an area for active recreation. It includes multi-use athletic playfields, a dog park, a playground for kids. It also includes a trail system that meanders throughout the whole park. It includes a parking lot of 97 spaces, and it also includes restrooms and a picnic grove. Now, the Parks, Rec, and Open Space Commission has been trying to move this park concept forward, and one of the major issues, obviously, is funding for such a park. But what came about after many PROS meetings is that maybe phasing out the construction of the park would be a better idea. And so in 2013, the PROS Commission decided to utilize their funds to hire Firma Landscape Architects to provide a phase one plan, cost of that plan, and also a hydrological analysis. And so Firma provided PROS with what you see on the screen here, which is the phase one plan. And what is the phase one plan? Basically, it's the infrastructure for the community park. It includes grading of the dog park, the parking lot, an emergency road. It also is the construction of the parking lot, 97 spaces. It includes the drainage infrastructure for the entire park. It includes the emergency road and also the dog park. Again, the PROS Commission has been trying to move this forward, and so in 2014, they used their department funds to hire civil design studios to do a topographic survey of the park, and that's in order for us to get our permits and to fine-tune all the grading and drainage that was necessary then. A major milestone came in 2015 when the CCSD board authorized the transfer of $159,256 from the Prop 1A funds to the Parks, Recreation, and Open Space budget to implement this Phase 1 plan. And in fact, the Phase 1 plan has been a goal of the board for the last 2 years. With that, with those funds available in 2015, the district hired Civil Design Studios and Firma to finalize the grading and drainage plan, a hydrology report, a stormwater prevention plan, an erosion control plan, and also to assist us through the permitting process for the park. In 2016, the PROS Commission also used their funds to add additional services to the contract with Firma and Civil Design Studios, and those additional services were to assist the district in permitting for the demolition of a house that is adjacent to the community park, 1777 Rodeo Grounds Road. The house that you see here has been empty for a number of years. It has structural damage from trees falling on it. It's been an area that transients have used to camp, so it's become a real liability, a real issue, and so we're looking forward to having it demolished. So where are we now at this point? Well, we have received the permits for the Phase 1 plan, along with the permits for the demolition of the house next to the community park. Our council has formulated the bid packet and the contract. And yesterday, in fact, we had a special PROS meeting where we discussed the bid packet, the contract, just to make sure that PROS felt comfortable with the process and with the bid packet that will go out. We're hopeful that the bid packet for contractors to bid on will go out next week, and we'll have the bidding for about a month after that. We'll bring back the winning bid to the board for you to approve. And so we're expecting that we can start construction of the park here in the next 3 months or so. As far as the funds that have been spent on the Phase 1 plan, as mentioned before, the PROS Commission over the past 4 years has allocated their department funds to move forward with the Phase 1 plan, with removal of trees, planning of Phase 1, topographic survey, biological monitoring plan, and engineering services. The total spent up to this point is $51,075. It's important to note, too, that the county has waived over $5,000 in permit fees, and we certainly appreciate the county for working with us on that. So at this point, we have $135,486 left from the Prop 1A fund to complete this Phase 1 plan. And I'll be happy to answer any questions you have.
I don't, anyone? Questions? I'm excited to see it happen. I'll tell you, it has been a long wait, and it's been worth the wait. I think the features you're starting with and acknowledging that Prop 1A money, and by the way, Merle Cliff, before he leaves, that was that was part of what he and I, when we were working on the budget, had thought, what a great use for that money. And because I think that has been huge in actually activating, and it's not really kind of hypothetical and talk anymore, it's real. It's getting permitted, and it's happening. So I just appreciate everyone's effort on this. It's a very exciting moment. Yes, Director Barner?
If Mr. Niven isn't going to make a comment, I really appreciate your long, hard work on this project, and run out there with a shovel. We'll get it done. Thanks.
Yes. So we thank everyone that's been involved in this over the years, the commitment and the sustained. It happens that way oftentimes that something that's really worthwhile just does take a long time. But a lot of good people have been involved. A lot of people have stayed in behind this. And certainly Steve Niffen. Where is Steve? Is he really here? I have yet to see him. And Steve, you have been instrumental in that. So I wanted to make sure we do recognize all your efforts too. And Carlos, thank you so much for the presentation. Appreciate it. Okay. Next on presentations, we have under item C on 3, we have next District Engineer Bob Gresham, and he will be talking to us about water system loss auditing and related Senate Bill 555 and 2015 compliance. Welcome this afternoon.
Well, thank you, Madam President, members of the board. I'm here to talk a little bit about the distribution water loss auditing and related Senate Bill 555 compliance. First of all, Senate Bill 555 is relatively recent. It was passed in 2015, and it requires urban retail water suppliers, the CCSD, for example, to submit a validated water loss audit annually to the California Department of Water Resources. And that begins in October 2017. But it also builds on an earlier Senate Bill, 1420, which was passed in 2014, which directed urban water suppliers to complete a water loss audit and include a quantification of the water loss in their urban water management plan, which I'm right in the middle of right now. And I'll talk about that a little bit later. There's a water loss technical advisory assistance program, or they call it the water loss TAP, and it's administered by the California-Nevada AWWA section, and it's funded by the state, and they provide water loss audit training. It's a very good program. I was fortunate enough to be able to go to their first training back on September 23rd. So some of the slides you'll see in this following are from some of that training they provided. So accounting for water. This is the, I hope I find this button correctly, the main table that the state goes by in organizing how you account for water. So you have on the left-hand column, the blue shaded is your total water supplied. So that's from our production wells. As you move to the right, it starts being refined into different categories. So you'll see you have authorized consumption, and then you have water losses. And as you go to the right of authorized consumption, you have billed authorization consumption, which is essentially your revenue water from your meters and some, if you have any billed unmetered, which we do not have. You have unbilled authorized consumption, and those can be from special agreements where you're providing water, and we have one of those special agreements in place that I'll talk about later. Then you have water losses for your where you have apparent losses, which are essentially some errors and inaccuracies that can occur in the system. And you also have real losses, which are your leaks and so forth. So I'll get into these next. So the auditing includes collecting and evaluating data. And it's actually, this is where the rubber meets the road. You have to, most of the effort goes into this area where you're looking at data. Is the data complete enough? Who has the data? Where is the data? You might spot something that's inconsistent, like this red dot that's highlighted on this plot, this example plot. This isn't our data, but shows, okay, oops, there's something way off here because it's just way out of bounds of what you'd expect. It's not meeting a trend. And we have had some of that, and I'll talk about that later. So is it accurate, which is near and dear to me, whether we have accurate data. So in the first major area of authorized consumption, again, you have these different categories of revenue water. Then you have some non-revenue water, which is the unbilled but yet authorized water. We have our customer billing is that top category. We don't have any billed unmetered consumption that I'm aware of. And we have some internal unbilled water. We have internal accounts. We have a little over 20 internal accounts that we meter, but we don't bill. We have a special settlement agreement in place from 2006 with Warren that provides a certain amount of water to that property. Then we also have some filtered backwash water that came out of the audit. That's not in our internal list that we report on a regular basis, but it is data that I had to consider in looking at 2015 and some other years. Lastly, you have unbilled, unmetered consumption. This would be for firefighting, for example. It would be for flushing hydrants. We talked a meeting or two ago about the need to flush hydrants. So we have distribution system flushing. That's another need where you know we need to do that. It may be unmetered, and most likely would be unbilled. We're, you know, Chief Hollinsworth and I had some preliminary discussions. Can we put some construction meters in the fire trucks, and how do we coordinate that so we can capture that? So we're looking at ways to try to make some of that metered in the future. And the same would be true as we flush the water system eventually and get on that. So there's some progress being made slowly on this. The next is the major category is what you call your non-revenue water, your water losses, and that's really the bottom line. You look at a percentage there that's important. The water volume reaches an end user but is not registered or properly tracked. The illustration on the left, a little photo, it's kind of hard to see in this light, just shows a pipeline that has probably a dozen or more little service connections. So you've got to ask yourself, well, first of all, why would they put that many connections on a pipe that close together? Are they all legally approved? So are there some that maybe were legally approved and didn't get onto the accounting system yet? Or how is the handshake occurring between when the application was made and when the inspection was done and when the installation occurred and when it went to billing? You know, there can be errors where you have unauthorized water that occurs. It just doesn't get caught in the system. The other picture is a meter, and as meters get older, they register poorly. So water has a tendency to go through the meter that is not indicated on the totalizer. So there's water that goes in the distribution system, goes through the meter, and it's not always captured and showed on the billing total. So you have, again, possible errors due to accounting and whether the handshakes occurred between inspection, permitting, and so forth, then you have the actual volume not being correct that's on the metered totals. We also have the physical losses or real losses in that chart. Those are leaks, seeps, and breaks. And you can't see through the ground. You can't spot all the leaks as they occur. You have some minor leaks throughout the whole distribution system that do occur. And those are mainly pressure-related. They're not really directly tied to how much water's flowing through the pipe, but they're more related to how much pressure's in the pipe throughout the town. I think we have at least seven different pressure zones. So we have, if you're at the bottom of the pressure zone, you have a pretty high service pressure. You're going to get a little more leakage in that area, as opposed to maybe the top of the pressure service zone where the pressure's a little less. But that occurs continuously, and it stays pretty constant. We will get breaks that alter that, and we do try to track our breaks as well. But again, we're still improving some of the quality of the data and the procedures that we track this data with. So the results from the 2015 calendar year audit, and this is really useful because it's actually one of my homework assignments for the next training session I go to, and I'm hoping to involve other staff as well in that session. But the pre-audit values, 2015, essentially the numbers didn't make sense. We had a total production of 467 acre-feet, and this was unaudited metered data. It came to 608 acre-feet. So that number should be somewhat less than 467. So we go, uh-oh, there's something wrong here with the data. And sure enough, some back-and-forth discussions, we found where some total numbers were incorrect on certain bi-monthly periods, and we've reposted some of that data already. But it should not be high. You're not going to produce water in your distribution system. You're going to lose some water in the distribution system. So that was a tip-off there. So then we did some post-audit number crunching, came up, you know, again, the total production was 467 acre-feet, but this time around, the metered after correction was about 419 acre-feet, so you had a production less metered of about 49 acre-feet, which is around 10.5% of lost water. And we had estimated roughly 8% in one of the earlier urban water management plans. 10% is pretty acceptable, generally speaking. I mean, our goal is to stay 8% or less if we can. And 10.5% is not all that out of range. Our water production to consider was also down, you know, 35 to 40% in approximate numbers compared to earlier years. So that also influences the percent water loss a little bit, because you have the real losses that were shown earlier. Those may stay the same because they're more pressure-driven than use-driven. So you end up with a little bigger percentage during drought years than you would during a normal year. And, for example, I'm looking at the pre-drought fiscal year of 2012 to 2013 because I'm going to use that in the urban water management plan because I have good financial data that's based on a fiscal year. And so that's going to go into the urban water management plan update. That came down to 6.3%. So just to give you an idea of a kind of pre-drought period, 6.3. Now we're doing a drought period audit at about 10.4 to 10.5%. That pretty much concludes what I had to cover here. I do want to give credit at this point to the AWWA California Nevada section, because I borrowed the illustrations from those trainers that they provided. And those were by two firms. The trainers at our session were by Water Systems Optimization and Cavanaugh & Associates. They did a great job. And I also want to give credit to our water department, our billing department, because without them, I wouldn't have any data. And they worked really hard putting that data together. And lastly, I want to give a little shout-out to Elizabeth Bentenhausen for raising everyone's awareness on this. She's been tracking it pretty closely and has been emailing me tables, and we've been going back and forth on this a little bit. So I want to thank Elizabeth for bringing this up to us as well. So thank you. That concludes my presentation.
We do appreciate it, and there's been a lot of conversation and awareness of water loss, but I think when you put it in perspective like this, so your conclusion after looking into this was that, yeah, it's about 10%. Is that correct, Mr.
Right,
Gresham?
Right, 10.5%.
And yet if we report it in gallons, of course, because 1 acre foot is what, 325,000 gallons? So 3 acres is around 1 million gallons. And 1 million gallons sounds like a lot, but when you bring it back and you look at total consumption compared to lost water, so to speak, and it's about 10%, I think it puts it in a much better frame for us rather than calling it millions of gallons, which, you know, it is. Every 3 acre foot is about 1 million gallons.
Yeah, and we want to stay diligent. I mean, one of the advantages of doing this audit is it gives you a broader picture of, you know, where your losses are, and, you know, try to refine your approach to bringing this down over time. You know, you can,
yes,
for example, meter replacement programs are important. Meters get old, that's lost revenue. I mean, that's water that you're providing that you're not getting any revenue on. But then there's trade-offs and costs. It's expensive to replace meters, but then you recover that cost over time. There's things we can do to detect leaks quicker in our system. There's some sub-metering you can do in the pressure zone so that you can tune in to, oh, we got a water leak, we better send operators out there right now, because you get instantaneous information versus a citizen calling up or one of our operators driving around seeing water coming out of the street. So there's things we can do in the future to keep pursuing this as a long-term goal to bring it down. But I think on an industry-wide basis, the 10.4% is not that bad, considering that we reduced our demand by about 35% to 40% during this year. So that pretty much is where we're at.
I just really appreciate it. I think all the information and then some of the data you're starting to now actually have here, we can see comparative looks over years too as we go forward, and then identifying, we don't want to lose any water, of course, no one does, but starting to identify some of those items that you mentioned that do contribute to it, what we might do to even reduce it further, I think those are all excellent. The only other question I would be interested in sometime might be, again, similar sized communities and districts, if we have any comparative data, if they know too. But I think just an occasional periodic report on water loss and bringing us up to date is very informative, and we have a big interest in it. So thank you.
Thank you. Yeah, we
and
will be doing
we
it
have
annually.
Some other comments from
yes, I have another
the board.
Comment.
Yes.
And I do know that this is an urban water management plan update that you're working on, and that's a very high priority of things. But I do know that prior to August 31st, in the June, July, and August timeframe, you were working very hard on use tabulations and projections for the EIR. And so there's a lot of work that's in the EIR that people should be able to look at. And I think those use you were tied up in that activity, and now you're working on this plan. Mm-hmm. I appreciate mm-hmm. the effort you did before and now. Thanks.
Well, thank you.
Director Rice?
I'd just be interested the next time we hear back about where the big data gaps are and what kinds of things we can do to help support providing the data so that we can not just know how much our water losses are, but address, like you were saying, with in the pressure zones, having ways to have the alarm set so we know those things are happening. So I'd like to see something going forward of how we can be supportive of keeping this, hopefully, to a lower than 10%, but at least it's low.
Okay, that makes sense. Thank
mm-hmm.
you.
Any other comments? Vice President Thompson?
Just one question. Does this include the water that's produced that goes to, for instance, the house out by the well field that we're required to provide X number of units to? I mean,
yes, that's correct. There's the Warren Settlement Agreement from 2006 that part of that had provisions in there that we have to provide water to the property that, for lack of a better term, we've referred to it as the one-room schoolhouse property right. that Clyde used to own. I think he sold it since this agreement was entered into. And then there's also another meter that goes on to his property that I think is rented as the equestrian center. So those two meters are in our internal accounts. And in fact, at least on one or two of those, we had some errors in the reading. That's why I had to spend some time going through records to get to this point. One of them is a compound meter and has two dials on it, and they turn over like a car odometer, and you can really get off on the totals if you're not careful. So there's some things that you spot as you're going through this data, with a more of a microscope, trying to figure out, you know, whether it makes sense or not.
So at some point in time, we'll perhaps be able to identify where the 40 acre feet go in the different categories and really pinpoint those,
yes,
those areas.
Yes, we have that, and we can probably start tailoring our presentations in the future to make that clearer when we show it. Yeah.
Okay, no other comments? Well, thank you for your hard work along with all the other things you do all the time, but this was very informative. Thank you.
My pleasure. Thank you very much. Okay.
And also, we have Chief Hollingsworth back now to give us a report on the urban, on the wildland urban interface presentation that we kind of been looking forward to for a while. I think we had this in May, didn't we? And I think it's... But here we are.
But here we are, exactly.
And what do we call wildland urban interface? WUI?
WUI, correct.
WUI. This is the WUI report.
And it is the WUI report, and it's a little ironic that it's happening today as the rain is coming.
WUI.
But please don't let that detract from the importance of what we're doing. This originally stemmed from a drill that we had the opportunity of hosting here in Cambria, and a couple of the board members had went around and saw what was going on with the fire service community and wanted to be able to kind of share what those were and then maybe just connect the dots on why we do some of the things we do. So the WUI drill is an annual event. We rotate hosting that, if you will. This was the last time we did it here in this town was over 10 years ago. It takes well over a year to put together, and the reason being is there's so many different players involved in this. And so a big thank you has to be given out to the county chiefs and the County Training Officers Association because they're heavily involved in making this happen. In Cambria, what we did is simulated a multiple strike, lightning strike fire event, and this would have occurred on May 5th. And one of the reasons we do it so early in the year is because we're too busy fighting fires as it gets into this part of the year. So this is the ideal time to practice it, along with the fact that the weather is a little bit more helpful. As you can see, we have a lot of participating agencies. There's well over the 20 that are listed. They're from at least Santa Barbara and San Luis Obispo counties. For instance, this drill is going to be hosted down south of Santa Maria next year. So it moves all around. It has been up in Monterey as well. Well over 150 fire personnel were on site, 30 different fire engines. And if you could see on the bottom, we were able to use the Caltrans yard at the intersection of Highway 1 and 46 as a meeting place and to be able to kick this off real early in the morning. Fundamentally, what we do is we break down the community. We developed three or four different training sites. Three were fire-related, and one was a CERT exercise. And if you can follow here at the bottom of town, down at the bottom end of Burton Drive, that would have been what we call Division A or Division Alpha, and people would rotate through the three exercise areas. Here they would be doing progressive hose lays, cutting line. Division M or Mary is along the Warren Street corridor, which abuts the top part of the ranch. And then Division Z up on Bridge Street is right in the middle of the Cavell Ranch up there. As I said, CERT was involved in this as well, and we'll get into how CERT was able to participate. If you look strictly at Division A, we're talking about this entire region that parallels all these homes is along the upper side of Burton Drive. And we simulated a lightning strike in the middle of that forest right in the Strawberry Canyon area. And then with the progressive winds coming in from the north and northwest, it would typically push it to the south end of town. In this area, we had crews practicing those skills, which are cutting line progressive hose lays. It was about a mile from each side, and they were able to meet in the middle. So we had multiple crews going in. A mile of hose is a lot of hose to pack up and pull out once you've put it on the ground after you've done this. But it's excellent practice. And so you can see all the engines piled up along the roadway as they were following crew in after crew in. Division M, the area off of Warren Road, was what we refer to as the structure protection area. This would have simulated a lightning strike in that upper portion of the ranch and the tree stands when you get above the grassy fields. And what really benefits us in this area and really shows why this is so important is that shaded fuel break that we put in all along the backside from Tipton all the way down to Marlboro. That cuts in about 100 feet behind those homes back up into the forested area. And the theory is that we'd be able to go in there and provide structure protection to those homes because we had that shaded field break in place. Now, that doesn't automatically then translate that you're going to save those homes, but it does make it more possible. And so what the crews did in this area was practice going around and evaluating each residence for savability, if you will. And then we have developed, or statewide has developed, this yellow triage tag basically for homes. They've adopted the triage component, applied it to home assessment. We could fill that out, leave that site, and then any other fire engine, any other crew coming through sees that, knows what the evaluation is, know what the hazards are, knows if there's pets on site, knows if there's a LPG tank outside. It's just a real quick assessment for us to know what's there and if it's something that we're going to be able to make any progress with. The last area was Division Z, which is up off of Bridge Street, and this simulated lightning strikes in the Cavell Ranch area. And what they did specifically here is that you have to have a lot of specific training in regards to chainsaw, tree falling, and stuff like that. Because of the density of trees in this entire area, a well-established fire could easily progress into what we call a crown fire, where it's burning through all the foliage up on top and then moving very quickly. In theory, if you're able to cut down enough stuff in advance of this, if the fire is moving through in this direction, you might be able to slow a progressive fire down long enough to be able to get in and put in dozer lines and possibly burn out sections and things like that. So people were out dropping very large trees on the property that had already been identified to enhance that shaded fuel break that we were able to put in a few years ago along Bridge Street. So a lot of these things were done in an effort to enhance what we've already been working on, and we were able to connect the training to it, which was fantastic. So the other component of this, we were able to, and very appreciative of the fact that CERT was involved in this. And not just in some of the aspects that you would consider. Yes, they were part of traffic control. If you imagine 30 engines driving around with their lights and sirens, tends to scare the community a little bit. They were able to kind of really direct traffic because getting that much apparatus on some of these one-way roads is very difficult. They were highly instrumental in helping there. They also practiced a mock evacuation drill of the Pine Knolls area and went house to house. You have to appreciate that in an event like this, fire personnel are not going to be going door to door. We're going to be in the field working. So CERT would be working along with law enforcement for the purpose of evacuation. The staging area managers were able to practice a lot of the components of what they're doing. And then also there was a fire safety fair that was held and staffed at the Catholic Church here in town, and they had a pretty decent turnout and were able to provide a lot of fire preventive information to the community. So why do we do all that? I would tell you, but I can't move the... I'm not sure what to... Okay, so I give you a little bit of this background to connect all the dots. The Oakland Hills Fire of 1991, it was technically called the Tunnel Fire. And this isn't to scare people, it's just the reality of what the potential is. A lot of people in the business of evaluating these type of incidents have specifically connected Cambria very closely to what happened in Oakland Hills because of the topography, makeup, density of homes, the age of the community, all those kind of things. So if you're able to connect all those dots, because this fire happened in October of that year, right in what we're doing right now, regardless of the rain that's happening outside, it burned over 1,500 acres, 25 people were killed, over 2,800 homes were destroyed. And at the height of this, when wind gusts were in excess of 70 miles an hour, there was more than one house burning every 11 seconds. And so you can't stop that. There's not enough fire personnel in the state to stop that. So when this gets that established, that's what we're a little bit afraid of and why we're hitting the fire prevention component of what we do so aggressively. If we could stop the fire from ever happening, we possibly can avoid this. So there was an estimated $1.5 billion loss in this, and this entire event happened in less than 3 days. Can we get the next slide, please? In relation, we just had the chimney fire here in the community. A quick recap of that is there was 4,600 acres burned. It was quite a bit larger. It took a lot longer for this fire to burn. About little over 70 different structures were destroyed in the process. And just to combat this, there was over 4,000 personnel on site. We did have personnel there as well for the entire time. And it cost us, or it does cost us, it cost the state, you, the taxpayers, over $200 million to put that fire out. Luckily, that was in an area where there was not a high residency density. So we're very blessed that that's it happened where it did. Next slide, please. So I tell you that to try to connect all these dots. We do this for the defensible space. Next slide. And this is something that is advertised extensively throughout the state throughout the summer, starting roughly in spring and pushed definitely down through fall. We really push the three zones of defensible space around every residence. That's difficult in the community this side because some of the parcels are so small. And that's why we have the fire hazard fuel reduction program to identify those parcels between improved structures. Because you're going to be able to get 50, if you try to get even 50, 25 feet past some of these homes, you're on somebody else's property. So that's why we have that program in place. Ideally, you're going to have that low ignition zone area around your home, and then it meters out past that. You reduce the foliage, reduce the trees, and reduce the shrubbery. Next slide, please. How do you do that? And this is in summation, you have to harden your home. And this is why what we're looking at to evaluate when we're going and doing the structure protection. If we see a home that these kind of components are not on, that home is not going to be savable in theory, and we move on to somebody else that does. So that's not to sound mean. That's just the cold reality of what happens during these incidents. And it, so ideally, secondary to the WUI code, which we have adopted, these are the ideal things you would have. Your roof needs to be made of non-combustible materials. Shake roofs are not appropriate. We don't do retroactive type stuff. We don't go back and ding people for that, but when they go through an evaluation process for a remodel, sometimes we're able to trigger those changes to harden their home and get them more safe. The vents in their attics, they have to be screened at 1/8 of an inch or smaller to reduce the possibility of flying embers. Eaves and soffits have to be boxed in because, as you can imagine, as the winds circulate all that, fires create their own winds, it'll create eddies right against the house and then keep all those embers right up against those soffits, which are made of wood typically, and in theory you can light those off. And then windows, if you could double or triple pane your windows, put tempered glass in there. Even if you break one pane, you've got other panes keeping the heat out of the home. Next slide, please. Continuing on this, the walls, if we can put non-combustible or fire-resistant siding on there, there's all kinds of studies done by NIST and other fire agencies that have proven the fire rates and burnability rates of the products that are being put on homes. So when we evaluate that and we tell people you have to put this kind of siding on a home or we have to put this kind of ignition-resistant decking on a home, there are physical studies that prove why you have to do that. So in the middle picture, you could see traditional combustible construction on the left. You could see fire-resistive construction in the middle and then heavy timber construction on the right. And so there's reasons why we go through the things we do. And it's a little difficult to see, but on the picture on the bottom right, those are rain gutters melting and burning off the home because there's been so much pine needle accumulation in the rain gutters. So why we have them screen the rain gutters in or have them clean them on a regular basis. Last slide, please. And the last things you can do is be prepared. And we preach that whether it's in relation to a fire, earthquake, tsunami, it doesn't matter. You need to be prepared in your home. So in this regard, if you're talking about a structure fire or foam fire around your home, have shovels prepared, fire extinguishers, hoses at the side of your home ready to go. Make sure your address is clearly visible from the street so we can find it in times of an emergency. And then try to maintain a water supply. And really, the two pictures on the bottom are just to show you the efficacy of how well these will work. In a large fire on the left, a fire hose is not going to do anything other than waste your water. If you have a small spot fire on the ground or near your home, a small garden hose very well could put that out. And that's why it's so effective to have those coiled and available at your house. And I believe, if you hit the next slide, that's the last thing in this. And in summation, basically all we wanted to do is show you what we do in the WUI drill, why we do it, and then connect the dots as to why that's so important in regards to fire prevention and safety around your property. So,
Thank you very much. It was a report that I have been looking forward to. I think it was quite a privilege and very impressive. I did get the opportunity to see all three different applications, and It was here in our community with our fire department, and CAL FIRE, I think, really the leads in this one. And what a wonderful thing, given our, I think, ongoing forever interest in how can we make our community safer and more proactive to the event or possibility of a fire, to have the whole thing here. I think that was really good. And we have so much going on in this community for all of us to be prepared. The ongoing kinds of things that you were talking about, the things that CERT does, and so, you know, our 1, 2, 3, ready, set, go kinds of things. I just think that we're very, very fortunate. But I think it's education for all of us as Cambrians that we need to continue to have those opportunities, because there are probably people that haven't, you know, they haven't even heard of ready, set, go yet. And so the more we can do with your leadership, with your insight, so that we've, you know, we're part of the solution here, the more I think it keeps our community safe. So I thank you very, very much for your work. Yeah. Any other comments? Director Rice?
Thank you for the presentation. I'm glad to see that we have so much training going on. That's awesome. If I'm in a house and I'm not sure about if the eaves are the right size, does the fire department come out and do that, or is that part of something that you provide?
Absolutely. Just like we would go out and do the smoke detector changes for people, we commonly will go to people's home, and it's maybe not that well publicized, and we can work on that, but we absolutely go out and do, we call them pre-fire inspections, if you will, and give people suggestions on how to harden their home. And that's everything from how to create defensible space and working with what they got, because not everybody is going to have the financial latitude to go and do all the things that we're talking about unless they're in the middle of a large remodel or something like that. But there are definitely steps they can take to improve their chances in the case of a fire. But absolutely, we will do that.
And just, I don't even know if it's feasible or possible to do, but has there ever been consideration of doing something like an evacuation drill for the town? That's not just that's based on how do people know how to get out of the way of the engines and get out of town safely. I mean, have we ever had a workshop or some? I know the CERT folks are all trained in that, but even though we have the largest CERT, I think probably in the country, we still don't have everybody in CERT. And I know that other communities have looked at trying to do that, maybe in concert with the local hazard mitigation plan or something.
It's possible. Some of that, it's a really good question. Some of that information does exist already. We've worked ad nauseum with CERT, Sheriff's Department, CHP, CAL FIRE, and have actually developed an evacuation plan for the community. It's printed and documented. We have multiple copies of it at the station. We give it out on a regular basis at public events. Unfortunately, it's probably one of those things that people look at and set aside and then never see again. We've tried to develop so it's small. It will easily sit on your refrigerator with a magnet, if you will. But it does exist. The problem comes in, how do you then train the community other than just having that information available? And the short answer is, I don't know. We train extensively on it. We do that cooperatively with CERT and other allied agencies, primarily because we're going to be the ones that are effecting that in whatever regard, for whatever the cause. But you can't really mobilize 6,500 people in a community and say, we're going to practice leaving, everybody get out, and then we're going to all go back and have a big barbecue. It's possible. I'm not really sure how it would work.
Barbecue?
But exactly. It would be a large barbecue. It's fundamentally very important that the plan is made, that we know how to make it work, and that we have that information available. Trying to keep it in the forefront of what people are considering as part of their Ready, Set, Go program is really, at this point, the best we can do unless we find some other logical way to address that with the community.
Mm-hmm. Thank you. Any other comments? Well, thank you very much for this presentation. Very informative, very important. Okay, moving on from our special presentations, agenda review. Do we have any items we wish to be pulled from the consent agenda or any other things? Director Rice?
I'd like to pull item C for
item
comment.
C?
Yes, please.
Okay, pulling item C, as in Charlie. Any other requests from the board? All right. So we will pull item C for discussion. Okay. And then we have public comment. And, of course, this is public comment up to 30 minutes, and it is on our anything that's under our jurisdiction as a community service district, as a board, but not on the agenda today. So we have two requests, and the first comes this afternoon from Christine Heinrichs. Good afternoon. We'll get the mic on first.
Ah, thank you.
Okay, now you could start. And okay. We'll start our time now, too. Who's okay. Starting our time today? Excuse me, Christine. Oh, okay, Mr. Carmel. All right, good job. All right, now we're ready. Thank you.
Okay. Thank you. I'm here to comment on the tour that Bob Gressens gave a group of us of the wastewater plant and the emergency water plant. It was extremely helpful, and he was very helpful, and Mr. Alchin, who's the plant manager, it just answered all our questions, really helped us to understand exactly what these processes are. And actually, you know, it was a group of about 10 of us, but, you know, if that could be offered to the community, it might be a real service, because it was so helpful in understanding what the issues are. But during that tour, issues came up that Mr. Gressens didn't have the answers for at the tip of his tongue, and so I followed up later with a list of those questions, and I was kind of surprised when it got bounced over as a public records request, which it obviously was not. So I thought I resubmitted those questions, and I thought I'd bring them along today and read some of them into the record. One of the questions was, what's in the backwash out at the emergency water plant, and how much is being pumped into that area? How is the water that's being used in the test going into production? That wasn't clear, and it wasn't able to go into production in the first test, which the plant did not pass, so I was curious about how that works. What's the cost? How much does it cost to produce this water? How much per gallon, per unit, per acre foot? You know, those are all different units that are confusing to the community, and it would help us to know about that. What does it cost to shut the plant down? It's been turned off and turned back on again. What does it cost to restart it? What's the process for storing those reverse osmosis membranes, which apparently that's one of the tricky parts of this. What is the power cost to operate the plant? That was on the emergency water plant. The wastewater treatment plant was also very interesting. And I certainly give the staff credit for managing without a full complement of trained employees out there, and I hope that's going well. Every place we go, I try to promote those jobs to young, bright people who might well fit into those, because the training is available with that, and those are really excellent career positions for young people. Mr. Alchin is doing a lot with bringing the plant up to better standards. We are looking into the future of having to do major repairs or even replacing that plant, so that's certainly something that the community needs to know more about. So I look forward to getting those answers, and thank you for your time.
Thank you very much. Next, on public comment, Harry Farmer. Good afternoon.
Good afternoon, Madam President, and other board members and staff. We're going to get some much-needed rain. How cool is that? I want to thank Engineer Gressens for his presentation on water loss in the piping and in our district here. He thanked Elizabeth Bettenhausen, who we know is probably one of the most knowledgeable people in our community with regard to just kind of being a watchdog on what takes place here. I happen to have the document that she sent to Engineer Gretchens with regard to water loss. I do want to mention in 2013, the amount was for the entire year just under 10%, according to Elizabeth. In 2014, the number was 16% water loss with regard to amount pumped and amount billed. Engineer Gretchens mentioned that it was about 10% in 2015. And while I don't have the total for the year, let me just read you the gradations from, it's in two-month periods, okay, so January, February, March, April, and so forth. So we have produced but not accounted for, 17%, just under 13%, 17%, 14%, 11%, and just under 14%. And just eyeballing that, I believe that comes to about 15%. So far this year, and so far this year, since it's two-month gradations, we're talking about January through August. We've lost about 13%, which is about 14 million gallons, if I'm not mistaken. In fact, since 2013, we've lost 85 million gallons. But that's not why I got up here to talk. It just happened that I had this information here, and I thought I'd pass it along to you. So there's actually two things I want to talk about. I hope I don't run out of time. The first one is this particular email that was received by a member of the community, and it was about an inquiry about the status of Cambria CSD financial assistance applications for the IPR Wastewater Effluent Quality Improvements Project. So this reply is from David Balgobin. He's with the Water Resources, he's a Water Resources Control Engineer with the Division of Financial Assistance Water Recycling Funding Program with the State Water Resources Control Board up in Sacramento. So he states here, you know, he's the financing project manager for the Cambria CSD, and with regard to, he's in charge of this application for the Wastewater Effluent Quality Improvements Project. He says, the status of their application is potential, as they have submitted an incomplete general application. The status will be changed to active once a complete environmental review package has been submitted. Then it goes on, regarding the CCSD application for the Fiscalini Water Tank Project, the application was determined to be ineligible for funding as the CCSD has commenced construction prior to approval. So here we
go. Mr. Farmer. I'm sorry, we are having problems with the timer today because the 3 minutes did pass, but we're not getting our buzzer, and so...
Well, so why don't you let me just finish what I'm saying here, okay?
Let's start the timer again.
Thank you. So I just want to mention the fact that, and this is information that I'm about to read. This is from the CCSD website. From the meeting, our regular CCSD meeting of August 25th, 2016. So it mentions here that for the particular fiscal year that we're in right now, the total revenue that's coming in is a little over $9 million. Total expenditures, a little over $11.5 million. So what we're talking about here is a loss of about $2.5 million with regard to the amount of money that we have and the amount of money that we're spending. And by the way, the Fiscalini Tank Project allocated for expenditures is $660,000. I just thought folks might be interested in knowing that. So basically, cash is projected to decrease during the year
Mr. Farmer, just to be fair to everyone else, right. So if you can bring it to a conclusion, I'd appreciate it.
Sure. So basically, the district is spending more than it's bringing in, while at the same time is not able to submit grant applications in an efficient and timely manner to get much-needed funding for important water and wastewater projects. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much. Next on public comment, we have Jeremy Payne.
Hello. I just came here to introduce myself to the community. My name is Jeremy Main. I'm interested in meeting with the district engineer. Let's see who else. I think that's about it for right now. I am, by profession, an information technology systems engineer. I am an internet technology security specialist. I have a nonprofit 501c3 technology collective that is focused on public education and on technology support through the community on sustainable living. I am into things like solar power. I'm into things like wind turbines, using 3D printers to print up fan blades. I'm into velodromes, electric bicycles, electric tricycles, sustainable living. I'll be going out and working with people who are homeless, who are on disability, who have little means or are stuck on government assistance, to teach them all these types of things and show them how to solder solar panels together, show them how to build lithium packs, show them how to use electric vehicles, no license, no insurance, no registration, and provide food, provide de minimis benefit for their volunteer effort, provide a stipend, and provide gift certificates at the end of the day for their effort in building these things. I've seen all this stuff here. It's important because this lifestyle is not sustainable, and it's going to come to a crash very soon. Our economy's done. Reagan said, beware of anyone from the government who says they're here to help. Well, that wasn't his. That's Ayn Rand. I am a staunch constitutionalist. I'm a staunch Levian Satanist. I am a libertarian anarchist. And I believe it's important for the people in the community to take accountability for themselves, to live a more sustainable life. That's my introduction to your community. Thank you.
Thank you. We have no further requests then for public comment under this item. And I think, because we've been at this a little bit, I'd like to take a break just before we begin moving into the general manager's report. So we'll take a 10-minute break. Thank you. Okay, Mr. Carmel will make a noise. Okay, so expect a noise from Mr. Carmel when your time is running short and running out. Okay, let's come back, and I'd like to reconvene the meeting, so please do take your seats, and we are ready to move on.
Roll 'em.
Okay, we're rolling, and we are going to first then start with now item 6 and the general manager's report. General Manager Gruber.
Thank you, Madam President. What I would like to do is, if I could go over the PowerPoint presentation first, if that's available. And then I'll go over my general manager's report and make a few comments on some of the comments that were made. But next slide, please. This is the M&O took down a very large pine tree that was next to the trail. I just want to go over, spend a few minutes on some of the work that's being done on the ranch right now. The question was asked, how do you resolve the tree mortality issue on the ranch, and this is how you do it. You do it one test plot at a time, you do it one tree at a time, but I think that we're probably doing more than has been done in a long time, you know, working with multiple agencies and working with FFRP, and so they're coming down. Next slide. M&O also chipped up a large pile of logs that were left behind by the last contractor. Not a real good slide, but you can see some folks back there in the back that they're taking some of the foliage that has been put on the ground and chipping that up. Next slide.
Got to turn my mic off.
You can't read this, but this is a Fiskalini Ranch Preserve forest cleanup and restoration. If I had my pointer, you can't really see it, but go back. Okay, right in the there's three test plots there. This is test plot 1, 2, and 3. They were a little over about 2 acres each, and it was completed on October 7th. A cleanup of hazardous trees and mulching of down logs completed June 29th of 2016. Also, the yearly weed abatement completed on July 2016. Test plots were done by CAL FIRE. So within that area, there are three test plots that were completed. We've talked about that before at the board meetings. Next slide, please. Again, this is some of the work that was done. This earlier slide was that tree, and that's what that pile of logs looks like. But if you look around the area around those logs, you can see that all the understory is cleared away, and it doesn't. It's not heavily vegetated. So when a fire would come through that particular area, it wouldn't burn nearly as fast, and it wouldn't cause the crown fire that Chief Hollingsworth was referring to. Next slide. Okay, this is some of the mulching that's going on. You can see a crews on the right left-hand side and the right-hand side. They're taking that down foliage and they're mulching it and they're putting it back on the ground and spreading it around. Next slide. This is some of the trails work that has been going on. You can see them. If you look at the pathway there on the left, those are just trees that have been cut down in the past and then just left, and they've been used as a trail, if you will. Well, all those eventually need to come out of there, and you see the gentleman on the right, a couple of them back in there, and they're just in the middle of it all trying to clear a spot away so they can start on the test plot area of that area right there. But again, a lot of old dead, dying trees, a lot of old foliage, but we're making progress slowly. Wanted to talk a little bit about the water department upgrades on the progress at the Sustainable Water Facility from Alpa Electric Services. The control cabinets have been installed at wells 1, 2, and 3, and I'll show you some pictures of that in a minute. Control equipment and wiring is in the progress. Radio links have been upgraded, and the links from the repeater near the PG&E substation to the well 2 have been installed and established. Radio links between all three wells have been installed and established. I know this is a lot of technical jargon, but it's all SCADA-related. Network conductivity between all three PLCs that's in each well have been installed and established, and preliminary programming to the PLCs and touchscreen interface, preliminary programming of SCADA integration. Next slide. So this is what it looks like. Those wires have all been cleared out on the bottom. This is the preliminary installation. So what we have now is SCADA stands for Supervisory Control and Data Acquisition. It's not just a monitoring capability. It's a capability that continuously monitors, but then will give you that information in real-time reports. And so if you had a well that had a meter and you went out and read the meter every day, you would have that meter reading information from that one moment in time when you read that meter. That makes sense. You go back the next day or the next week and you read it, and then you have that real time. If you had a pH or a chlorine meter and you went out and got a test from those pH and chlorine, you would get that sample at that one given moment. And you wouldn't get any more information, empirical information, until you went back out. SCADA gives you the capability to have that information all the time. So when you're looking at improving your infrastructure, building your tanks, building your distribution system, building your wastewater treatment plant, your water facilities, your urban water management plan, you're going to have information available that you could never have if a human was going out there and periodically getting those samples or getting that data and writing it down on a piece of paper. It also enables you to create reports, create graphs, things like that. So next slide. Next slide. This is a sample of this. Now we're going. This is a sample of 24 locations in the most critical wells. We're talking about the Fiscalini tank now, and I'll talk a little bit about that in my report too. We're checked by a radiographic testing X-ray by the third-party lab. All firms were reviewed by the ATS district consultants. All locations passed, indicating good work by Krosno welders. So in other words, they're not visually checking the quality of the work. by eyeballing it. They're using high-tech information to ensure that those welds were done properly and done according to specifications. Next slide. The tank welding is expected to be completed by the end of this month. So they're referring to the end of this month, which is October. Next slide. So the third shell ring is up, and the tank is at 24 feet finish height. ATS continues to provide the required full-time inspection during structural welding. And if you remember, this tank was literally on the verge of falling apart, so we had to do it, and we'll talk a little bit more about that. Next slide. There it is. That's starting to come together. It looks like a reservoir. Next slide. This picture shows the welding process that I use on the horizontal joints between the shell rings. Next slide. A little bit of the same. Next slide. That's some of the roofing panel that's going into place. Next slide. The crew is installing the roof on the tanks, the tank at the Fiskalini. Next slide. This says rafters are specially cut and formed as a portion of the roof plate to eliminate inaccessible areas. Inaccessible areas are not difficult to paint, or are difficult to paint and maintain. This design detail is a result of a collaboration between the district, the engineer, and ATS and Krasno Construction. It is expected that the result is in a longer-lasting tank with a lower maintenance cost. So before we put this out to bid and the specs were designed, we had to make sure that it was the same physical size as the other tank, because that expedited the process. But between Justin and myself and Bob and William Bellis and the tank contractor, we came up with a slight variation from the previous design that will enable this tank to be coated properly and for it to last a significant amount of time longer than the old bolted tank we had. Next slide. That's from the inside looking up. That thing that you see that looks like a cone, a tank fills from the bottom, and then the water cascades down. It's designed to aerate, so that's that kind of little thing you see up there, and that's what happens. Next slide. So we talked about we discovered some vandalism out at the perimeter fence. This really was derived from a call that the Regional Water Quality Control Board got, and in result of that, they came out and did an inspection, and they were concerned about two things. They were concerned about deer getting into our area, our facility, and they were concerned about gophers. And so we met with them, and we're working with them to put a remediation plan into place to get rid of the gophers. And then also, we really weren't sure where the deer were coming in at, or where they were coming in from. We actually thought about replacing up to 500 feet of fence, which would have been pretty costly to the district. But we wanted to make sure that the fence that we had in place, the integrity of the fence. So John Alshin, this is all poison oak and everything, he crawled through and got crawled way, way, way back in there where no man has gone, I think, probably for years, other than the person who cut this fence, and found the area. And so we did... we turned in a vandalism report to the police or the sheriff's department. The case number is 1610-09332, if anybody's interested in that. And then we went back. John and Travis repaired the hole in the fence behind the brine pond. This picture is of the hole through the brush. So I want to say thank you to them, because we were going to spend some money, and John said, let me give a minute and see if I can get back in there and find where the hole was. We know it was cut because it was cut so cleanly, and then it was rolled back very precisely. So it wasn't like a wild boar or something like that. And so it didn't result in any vandalism to our water facility, but it did result in having to do a report and really raising our level of concern that that somebody would do something like this. But we don't want to speculate. It could have been done years ago. It could have been done by homeless people. We don't know, although I don't think homeless people carry bolt cutters and take the time to roll a fence back like that, but that's something else. One more slide, please. Here's the final repair. You can see that it will not allow deer to come in anymore. Next slide. And these are just some of the slides we do. I mean, I could sit here all day and go over slides on the infrastructure repairs we're making. We had a manhole repaired and reset. If you see that it's broken like that around there, it's caused by trucks. That causes I&I. When it rains, you get infiltration and intrusion, which it's just water that goes to your plant. You've got to treat it. It causes hydraulic overload. So we're aggressively repairing things like that to stop the water from going into the sewer. One more, please. This is a fence around the wastewater plant has been repaired. You know, we've had some issues with deers getting in the wastewater treatment plant, too, and we thought we repaired all the fences. We really did. Well, then we went back and cleared that whole vegetation out behind the wastewater plant, just did a really thorough job, and we found one additional area that needed to be replaced and repaired. So we feel real confident now that all the fence around the perimeter of the wastewater plant has been taken care of. Go ahead, one more. The staff's identified manholes that need access. They have trees and other debris removed to gain access again. So a lot of our manholes are like in areas like Strawberry Canyon and things like that. We have to be able to get into those to jet them, to clean them, to videotape them. And so what we're doing, and this is something we haven't done for a couple years. If you remember when I first came on board, we aggressively did 20% of the system. We're going back out and we're finding areas that we need to have access to. If there's an SSO, a sanitary sewer overflow, you have to be able to respond to it as soon as possible and get the lines cleaned out. So the guys are out in the field and doing those things. Just a few things on my general manager's report. I've listed the public records request. I think that's you can see that we've had 16 of them, and so if each one takes 3 or 4 or 5 hours, you're looking at a lot of staff time. But again, that's something that the public has a right to do. But I would encourage, if you have any questions, you want to meet with us, just come on in and meet with us. We have expanded the CCSD hours of operation. We're now Monday through Thursday, 9 to 4. And previously, due to reduced staffing levels, our hours of operations were adjusted from 10 a.m. to 5. And we're going to continue to try to maybe even expand that a little bit more. As we know, the sustainable water facility is fully operational. And I indicate there that staff is at all levels from the water department are getting trained. As of right into this report, I said that we were running for 18 days, the sustainable water, tracer study. It's now 27. We started it September 3rd. When I wrote this report, we had 137 public comments regarding the SEIR. We now have 210. The Fiscalini tank, just want to clarify a few things. It's on schedule, and we did bring an agenda item to the board April 28th, 2016, asking the board to approve the contract. And in that staff report, and I have a copy right here, and I can give it to anybody who would like it, we outlined three scenarios with regards to financing that tank. One was to apply for a low-interest loan. The second was to self-fund, and the third was to look at somebody like a Muni Services. We were told we could go ahead and start the project and that we would be eligible for a low-interest loan. But once we started it and we submitted the necessary paperwork, we found out that wasn't the case. They also asked for numerous documents that we simply did not have relating to that particular project. They asked for an operations a plan. There's two or three other documents. So we soon realized that was not a viable option for us. The second option is to self-fund, which we're doing. The bottom line is we needed to replace the tank. We couldn't wait. And the third option is to go with Muni Finance or something like that, and that's what Patrick's looking into, and I can have him call that. So there is no conspiracy or anything like that. The board, when we brought this staff report forward, it clearly delineated three choices, and the board was fully aware and the community was fully aware of those three choices, with the possibility of not being eligible for a low interest loan. So I just wanted to clarify that. Also, with regards to the application for our grant, not a loan, but our grant for the wastewater treatment plant, I go up there on a regular basis, and the email that was read is accurate. It is a correspondence from the regional State Water Resources Control Board. But what it doesn't say is that when you submit for a grant application, we are on the project list. We're not going to go off that project list. But the problem is there's no Prop 1 money right now. The money that was allocated by the Proposition 1 funding was very quickly gobbled up. And I think that there's probably a ratio of somewhere around 2-1 or maybe even 3-1 for the applications that were submitted versus the funds that are available. I mean, that's just the reality of it. There's legislative talk right now about doing another proposition, if you will, a Proposition 2. I don't know what they're going to call it. Everybody realizes in Sacramento and at the Regional Water or State Water Resources Control Board that there has to be more money made available. In parallel to that, then we can continue to evaluate the long-term needs of the wastewater treatment plant. But remember, the driving force behind upgrading that, we talk about upgrading or approving it or replacing it, will really be and really should be determined by the State Water Resources Control Board. We have made significant improvements to that wastewater treatment plant. I would say it's probably in better mechanical shape and operational shape than it has been in 20 years. What we don't want to do is we don't want to move forward with a design without knowing the established criteria set forth by the Regional Water Quality Control Board as it relates to TMDL, total maximum daily load. So they may come and say, okay, we're going to, and it'll be a phased approach. They'll say, within 5 years, we want you to do this. Within 10 years, we want you to do this. Within 15 years, we want you to do this. It won't be a hammer. In order to progressively make changes to the facility. But we do not want to design and build and fund a facility that maybe only removes 5 milligrams, down to 5 milligrams of nitrates, and they come back and say, we want the receiving waters to have zero. So we have time. I think we're doing all the right things. I think that I travel to Sacramento regularly. I'll probably be going back up there the 1st of December, meeting with those folks. I had assurances from them. I sit across the table from them that even though our application is not complete, there are a lot of folks whose applications are not complete. And even if the application was complete, there is no money available. So we'll keep going. We'll keep pushing for legislation that allows us to have more money. The Urban Water Management Plan Bob touched on, we're working on that, and we've done the public notice part of that, and we should have that done in the next couple months or so, which will allow us to get the 5% that they're holding for our retainer relating to the Prop 84 and the grant funding that we got. I stand behind Bob's numbers. Bob did a great deal of research, spent a great deal of time coming up with that presentation. And so I'm confident that his numbers are accurate. And again, if there seems to be a disagreement in those unaccounted for water numbers, then we would ask that to whoever has those concerns come in and talk with us, and we'll work it out. There's been some conversation about the status of the WOGU intent to serve letter, and I just wanted to clarify that publicly. The building permit was issued on October 20th, 2014. The CCSD declared a Stage 3 water emergency in January 30th of 2014. CCSD has advised the WOGUs that the CCSD Board of Directors would be reconsidering their action taken to suspend the intent to serve letter on June 15, 2016, at their June 23, 2016 board board meeting. On October 19, 2016, the Water Department verified there was no meter and no connection at the water system on Evelyn Clort property where the WOGU intent to serve letter is located. On November 29, 2012, the WOGU project purchased 325 retrofit points at the cost of $16,200. So there's no house being built. Well, there is a house being built, but there's no issuing of water to that property or anything like that. We just wanted to clarify that. The CCSD website, we're doing a complete makeover, so stay tuned. It's up and coming. A lot of good changes. I like to see people show up at the meeting and say, I got this off the website. They haven't been able to do that before, or I haven't been able to find the information. So it's encouraging that they can at least find the information and they're navigating it through successfully. So Bob covered the consumption unaccounted for water. Cat 5 was awarded our LHMP, which is our local hazard mitigation plan. The kickoff meeting for that is November 14th. And I'm going to be asking folks from the Water Department and the Wastewater Department to come. And Chief Hollingsworth's already all over it. But the purpose of a local hazard mitigation plan is to make sure that all the areas that we're responsible for, if there was a natural disaster, that we address mitigation measures relating to those facilities. So it's not just fire. So we have to have the district engineer and the water department and wastewater facility and resources. So it's going to be a group effort. I continue to speak with and work with Dean Flores on a regular basis. Emailed him today, and when I mean a regular basis, it's a regular basis. He's still working real hard on our behalf, and I'm glad he's on board. I just wanted to touch base on the fire truck has been ordered. We finalized all the documents. The purchase agreement and the financing documents have all been finalized. And also, we'll be talking about some future grants later on here in the program or later here on the board meeting. But also just wanted to thank Chief for – I really enjoy working with William. I think you guys can tell that he's just top-notch. He's professional. He's coachable. I'm coachable. He's just a really a fantastic fire chief. I'm so happy that he's on board. I talk about the pros meeting. We decided on a fence for the dog park. I let everybody know at the pros meeting yesterday we're not leaving until we decide on a fence for the dog park. So we decided on a fence for the dog park and the construction of it. And the really nice part about it is Tim Roush, who is really involved with the dog park folks, supported it. And so those specifications for that fence, no climb fence, it'll be made of material that is, it will last a long time. But more importantly, we got Tim's buy-in, and I think that was important. I talk about the Veterans Hall just really quickly because it is a focal point for our community. This is our community center. I talk about that many important events have a rich history in Cambria are conducted in the Veteran Hall to include programs that benefit the American Legion, the youth, nonprofits, civic clubs, fundraisers for families in need, and public meetings and forums. When something bad happens in the community, a group of people come together and they get in the kitchen and they sell dinners and they generate revenue for that family. Whatever it may be, we see it happen time and time again. So this facility is important to the community. And the most recent Prop 218 process for Mission Country disposal included a pre-approved rate increase to take effect January of 2016 and 2017. Please see the attached letter from Mission Country Disposal regarding the January 1st, 2017 rate increase. I have contacted Mission Country Disposal and Integrated Waste Management Authority regarding the above reference item in addition to the compost gas facility. I have asked Integrated Waste Management Authority to provide a presentation to the CCSD Board of Directors and to the community regarding the compost gas facility in November. So we need to have that presentation again. The gentleman that came last time, if you remember, we had a power outage and he couldn't show it. So everybody's on board with this compost facility. I had some questions that I needed to ask, and I asked him, and I got the answers. I've started attending the general manager's meetings again for the CSD. I think that networking is important. And one thing, if it's okay with Madam President and the board, is Patrick does a really comprehensive finance manager's report. And there was a comment made earlier about, and I just want to paraphrase, about being $2 million in the hole or something like that. If it's okay, I want Patrick to come and talk just for a few minutes about our resources and our cash flow and where we are, because I think it's important to address questions like that. So hopefully we can answer that person's question, but really kind of let everybody know where we are financially. And with that.
Okay. We're always happy to hear from our budget manager. Welcome.
Thank you, Madam President, members of the board. I believe what was being referenced is the cash flow projection that's in the finance manager's report. It's on page 8 of the finance manager's report. And it shows that we, at the beginning of October, we had $3.5 million in cash. And between now and the end of the fiscal year, which is June 30th, we expect to receive another $7.7 million, and we're going to spend $8.7 million. So we're spending $1 million more than we're taking in over the course of the rest of the year. And that's accurate, but it's not that it's unbudgeted. We have part of those expenditures is $1.3 million is for the sustainable water facility, and that's cash that we already have on hand from the budget, the loan and the grant that we received. So we have this cash in hand already. We don't need to worry about cash flow. We're going to be okay at the end of the year. I just trying to keep it in perspective so everybody understand.
Thank you. And that was good clarification, because the way it was sounding, it was like, you know, we're not going to be, even with a balanced budget, making ends meet. Right. So it's good to explain how that does work.
It's just unfortunate.
Director Sanders?
Yeah, it's just unfortunate that Harry Farmer is not here to hear what the facts are.
This is true. Any other comments? Okay, another comment? Okay, no comments then. Any further comments from?
No
request for public comment. So, Vice President Thompson?
Yeah, I just want to make to comment on a part of the report. I understand full well that during a campaign, a lot of stuff gets thrown against the wall, hoping that something will stick. And I've heard recently in the community that because the office hours or office for public coming into the office were only 5 hours, 6 hours, whatever, that our staff only worked 5 or 6 hours a day. And that is such an absolute flat-out fallacy. I mean, it's there are many things that go on between the hours of 8 and 5 or 8 and 6 or whatever. So I think it's really unfair to our staff to make them hostage to a political campaign by suggesting that they don't work 8 hours a day. So I'm happy to see that that we're going to have another 2 hours of public counter time, which comes out to 7 hours a day. But please, that doesn't mean that they only work 7 hours a day. Thank you.
Thank you.
Madam President, just really quick.
Yes.
And I didn't mean to interrupt. I'm sorry. And we also, when we're not closed, if there's a pressing issue and somebody calls, we will open the office and meet with them and help them on any issue that's of importance, whether it's a questions they have or anything like that. So we're technically not open other than the hours that we indicate, but unofficially we are. So I appreciate that comment, Michael. Director Thompson, but also I always goof this word up. Millennials, is that what they are? Millennials. I'm a Gen Xer, and then there's baby boomers. I'm a baby boomer, I think. But the millennials, these young folks that we're getting in, that will be replacing us older folks, they are just incredible. The Haleys and the Stephanies and then soon to be Bob's assistant. They bring a breath of fresh air to the district and to the community, and they're highly motivated, highly educated, and everything I heard about him is absolutely untrue, as having kids that age. So we're getting some really good staff in here, and you know, my hope and prayer has always been that we get really good, top-notch employees, water, wastewater, fire, admin, and that's been happening, and I'm really thankful for that, because as people transition out of the district, we need people that are going to be here to lead the district tomorrow and into the future, because we won't always be here. So I appreciate that.
It does have a special energy, and it's you know, a team that works well together, and I give you great credit for that too. And then I somehow noticed that our budget manager works well after five, many days. And you know, I think it's really an unfortunate thing when people don't understand, and I think it's a misunderstanding because the hours are such that it looks like maybe 5 hours. But I have always noticed when I'm around, and I'm sure others have, that people go over and above an eight-hour day frequently.
Well, I'm not trying to belabor this, but I look at our department managers, and literally we are on call, and we will answer at 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. So I think that I'm speaking of for Monique and Bob and myself and Chief and Carlos and you know, it's just, but that's what we do, and we enjoy it, and we love doing it, and we're going to continue to do it. So I just appreciate all the positive comments, and staff appreciates that too. We know we're appreciated.
Thank you for the report. And Director Rice?
Thank you so much for your report, and the mentioning about the fence. I'm glad to see that Mr. Austin didn't just wholesale replace the fence. He actually tried to. I like to have a culture where we try and see if we can narrow down what the issue is instead of just replacing everything with something brand new. As we shift from working on our infrastructure in emergencies because there's a break or because we're getting better handle on all these things, to urgent, to then being on a maintenance schedule, I mean, there's a lot of pipes we need to replace, but there was a lot of money spent putting in the SCADA, and it would help, I think, with the budgeting if we can figure out a roadmap. If there's a roadmap already in place, that would be great. It would help. I mean, when we spend a lot of money on all the electrical parts to make the electrical boxes look great, when they're not broken, I understand we need to do these things, but is it more important than doing the pipes and just setting those priorities? Because we don't really, as far as I know, we don't really have a roadmap, and I don't want to just be spending a lot of money when we could be spending it someplace where it makes more sense to spend it. I mean, that's more of a budgeting topic, but I just wanted to bring up the both the concern and the appreciation that we're getting a handle on some of this infrastructure stuff so that we are no longer just in time fixing stuff. We're actually getting a handle on a plan, which is, I think, important for keeping the costs down, personally. On the Wagyu, do we know how... Do we know how they got a building permit? I mean, because they had a letter of intent, they were just able to get the permit because they had a letter of intent from the district. I'm just kind of confused how that. Yeah. This is one of those things we need to know where the breakdown happened.
No, absolutely. I'll let Monique, and then I want to, if you don't mind, I'll answer a few of your questions. Yes. It does. It says an update. The building permit was issued on October 20th of 2014. The CCS, he applied. No, this is for Fiscalini. This is not the staff report for that. So, but we did bring a staff report to the board that had a detailed a summary of, remember those, all those different accounts, and Wagyu was on there, but I can get that information for you. I don't think there was...
Is this going to be coming back to us?
Well, yes, because you remember as part of the conditions of the Stage 3 drought emergency, the district decided not to allow any new connections. Well, then what we brought to the board was an analysis of those grandfathered meters, if you will, right? The wait list or the grandfather. We brought you, yeah, existing commitments. We brought you a detailed summary of all those, and you chose not to take action on those. But out of all those existing commitment lists, WAGU was the only one that you could make a decision on that would allow that to happen and still be. It would just require a slight modification to the stage three or an exemption from that particular one. But I think the concern was is that as the house was being constructed and being built and things like that, that they were getting water from the CCSD. And so in my staff report here, I just mentioned that we did go out and confirm on Evelyn Court that there is no meter there. And I think that's important because there was some concern raised by members of the community about that, and so that's not the case. So,
and I might add that from that concern from the community, I did go out there, like I said I would, and I also talked with the county. They had and do have a legitimate active building permit. They are building. We don't have any water there connected, no meter. So when I was there, I did ask, because it was in the framing and siding, not even the exterior, but just the next layer after the framing. And so I asked the people that were working there that day, when they need water, what are they doing? But they had a huge tank there with water, mm-hmm. too. And I think it's important, and it's something that people had a misunderstanding about, because I think people thought they were actually building without a building permit. But the county assured me, no, they have their building permit, which I didn't know you could build without a water connection. But I found that out.
Can I?
Yes.
Can I be
Mr.
brief on a new
Behringer?
Subject? I want to pile on a little bit to Ms. Rice's concerns about having maybe a 3 or a 5 year budgeting process. I know we have a CIP, but I would hope that in the out years that we have, rather than just an annual budget, we have one that goes out a couple of years so that we can make sure we have the right resources available, and especially as we're starting to approach a possible sewer commitment, even though it's farther out than 5 years, at least we should have a view farther out. I don't know what the finance manager thinks about that. Do you have a 5-year budget? I don't think so. No. Okay. But I'm just adding on to that concern that Director Rice has. That's all.
Thank you. Any other comments from the board or staff? Okay, then thank you for the general manager's report. We will move on now to item 6B. Do we have any ad hoc committee reports or other related board member reports?
I have one, an extensive one, perhaps.
Yes.
I went to the CSDA.
Do we need to turn the clock on?
Yeah. I went to the CSDA conference and got some good, a lot of vendors will tell you that they can consult and give you these good things. And I got a couple of certificates that are suitable for framing. And laser-free Rio can solve all our problems, but our community really isn't into a lot of consultants. And a lot of times they're for districts that are bigger than us. I was happy to see that when I got there was a hanger on my door that said, make a green choice, we'll give you $5 a day, actually, for every day you don't have your sheets changed and stuff. I thought that was kind of nice. I got this, I'll try and be even briefer than I thought it was going to be. There's a report on February 2015, that's not that very far ago, when we had the most significant droughts, and we were going into or just came out of a four inch per year rainfall in our area, and I was very happy to see that there's been some droughts in the past that are not so bad, that were worse, and so that made me feel a little bit better. And then the September 16th drought and water year plan that came out. September of 2016, we're talking about a couple of weeks ago, they talk about the amount of heat that we're starting to have in the environment. And for those people that didn't have the the preconception or the ability to be able to have a safe and reliable water supply are going to feel much worse than we are. We have something that's sustainable and safe, and our community is one of the few that have that resource, and I think that makes me feel a lot better. Also, I didn't get a chance to take a tour of the Carlsbad desal plant, but I did have some information here that the total capital cost was $1.03 billion. They're purchasing water for $2,386 an acre foot. I don't know how much it costs us to produce, but it'd be kind of interesting to find out in the future what it is. And it turns out that they began operations in December of 2015. When was ours started? About the same time. Our water plant was started, and they had 20 years of working on it, and it turns out they're going through permitting and procurement is underway for a plant intake and discharge modifications because they were piling on to a power plant. So they were using an existing outfall and an existing infall. So they're concerned about that. And I think perhaps the Coastal Commission will be looking at that, and we might be able to jump on that bandwagon. And during the I haven't confirmed this, but during the talk, the guy said it's $100,000 per acre foot to build storage, to build a dam and have storage. So we certainly were able to get by with a pretty darn good plant, and we're up and running, and I think our community can feel good about having that in place. So with that said, that was my experience there.
Well, very, very informative. Very informative. Director Rice?
I attended the Monterey Bay National Marine Sanctuary Advisory Council. They met here just last week, and they did. The reason I went was they were doing a presentation for the Coast Discovery Center up in San Simeon. It was a very nice, well-done presentation about what they do, all the things they do up there for that program. And then the thing that I was more interested in was they have a bunch of different citizen science programs where they are training citizens to do things like get data regarding first flush and what kinds of contaminants are going into the sanctuary. And they have a bunch of different programs that mostly are centered up toward the Monterey area, but I know there are a few things going on down in this area, and I don't know if those data points are getting to us, because they said that they do have folks that are looking at data from our two watersheds. So it would be nice if we could maybe coordinate, or there was a way that we could be getting involved in those programs, because I know that more data helps people make better decisions and can help us protect the environment both onshore and offshore in the sanctuary. Anybody that wants to find out more, contact me. I'm in the book.
Very good. Thank you. And Vice President Thompson?
Yes, thank you. I attended the Parks Recreation Open Space Commission meeting yesterday, but there's been a lot of discussion on that already and Mr. Mendoza's presentation, so I think I'll leave that at that. I also attended the Cambria Fire Safe Focus Group meeting yesterday, and there was quite a bit of good information coming from that. Firstly, there is a free chipping event, which will be coming up on December 1st and 2nd. Letter here, this form, will be available in a number of locations, including the district office, the Cookie Crock, Chamber of Commerce. And so anyone that has, not brush, but branches and so forth that that they want shipped, excuse me, get one of these and turn it into the fire department, and they'll put you on the list for that on December 1st and 2nd. The other thing that was mentioned, and I think it's pretty good news, the greenhouse gas grant for biomass project is coming out, and Dan Turner, who's with the
Fire Focus
group, will assist our district in putting together an application for those funds. And so That's something that I'm sure that we're all anxious to move forward on. So that's out there. On November 9th in Vets Hall, the UC Berkeley Extension will be putting on a presentation on the problem of sudden oak death syndrome, which I guess is an issue that becoming very problematic, as with our own dead Monterey pines. And so they will be coming to present on that, and so hopefully we'll get a good turnout from members of the community. Shirley Bianchi, former Supervisor Bianco, was very appreciative of Mr. Gruber for making the hall available for that presentation. And then finally, not from the focus group, but just as a point of information, next Tuesday, the 1st, the Sons of the American Legion will be putting on a benefit spaghetti feed at the hall for the young man that passed away last week. So that will be happening from 4 to 7 on Tuesday. And that concludes my report.
Thank you. I think that's all of our reports then from the board. So, General Manager Gruber, are we ready then to move on? I think we'll move to the consent agenda, and we have an item pulled. And so first let's go ahead and approve what...
I'll move that we approve the consent agenda items 7A and 7B.
Second. Okay.
And it's been moved and seconded that we will approve items A and B on the consent agenda. Any discussion? No? Okay. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Motion is passed, 5-0. And then on item C, consideration of adoption of Resolution 40, 2016, declaring two vehicles surplus and authorizing sale by the general manager. We want the general manager to address it first, or?
Just your question?
Okay, why don't you ask your question?
I know that we have policies and there's laws involved in selling property that's owned by the district, and I don't know what our I know we have a purchasing policy, but I don't know what our vehicle maintenance and purchase and replacement policy is, and if we even have one. And I just wanted to take this opportunity to say, let's get one if we don't have one, and if we do have one, I'd like a chance to look at it. I think it's a good budget issue that needs to be looked at, because we do have a fair number of vehicles and some of them are quite old and are being replaced. But I'd like to do it not just as an ad hoc, let's get a new truck. I'd like to know that we have a plan.
Yes, General Manager Gruber?
Yes, so most places have a fund set aside. They give a vehicle a life expectancy, I guess is the word, 7 years or so, and then they put money aside each year. Well, since we had not done that in the past, and since there were so many vehicles in need of replacement within the district, what we opted to do, and since financing is at such a low interest rate, what we opted to do is if a department needs a vehicle replaced, let's say water, wastewater, or facilities and resources, we essentially finance that vehicle for 5 years, and then within the budget, you'll see a line item of $500 per vehicle per month per department. So what we've been able to do is instead of putting a large sum of money aside, the only department we haven't done that for is for the fire department, and I strongly suggest we do that. There are other areas. Now, those are just the vehicles that run around every day. You know, our I call them our fleet vehicles. But there are some additional needs, and we do not have a policy, and we really should do it through the budget process. And that's for those larger vehicles, such as backhoes. Our dump truck is really, 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 really old, and needs to be replaced. Our Vactor truck, the Vactor truck at the wastewater treatment plant. What's interesting, though, is there is a public utility website that John Alchin found out, and there are huge utility districts for cities like Detroit and New York and things like that who have the program that I'm referring to in place. And so they go through these vehicles fairly quick. In other words, a Vactor truck would be 3 or 4 years, a backhoe, a dump truck. On those larger particular items, I would recommend considering that as a policy. I can't make a recommendation, but going to those websites, getting involved in the bidding process, making sure that they're mechanically sound. For example, we could get a nice dump truck right now for $30,000 that would meet the district's needs as opposed to spending $70,000 or $80,000. We could buy a Vactor truck from this website, a nice Vactor truck that's probably going to last us for another 10 or 15 years, between $75,000 and $125,000 versus $400,000 or $500,000. You know, being a small district, we can't afford to do that. So to answer your question about our vehicles, our everyday vehicles, we kind of allocate money for them in the budget. The larger vehicles, no, we don't, but we need to put something in place. I absolutely agree with you on that.
Madam President, I move that we approve consent item 7C.
Second the motion.
Okay, it's been moved and seconded. No further discussion. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Aye. Opposed? Motion carries 5-0. Thank you. We'll move on now to item, we don't have an item 8. We'll move to item 9, regular business. And General Manager Gruber, if you would introduce item 9A.
Thank you, Madam President. And then I'm going to turn it over to District Counsel Tim Carmella. And then we also have Patrick here to maybe answer any financial questions. But 9-8 is discussion and consideration of adopting a resolution 41-2016 extending the suspension of the enforcement of surcharges/penalties relating to water conservation measures, restrictions on the use of potable water, and maximum water use allotments. Thank you.
Thank you, Madam President, members of the board. The suspension of the enforcement of these penalties, the penalties went into effect in March of 2014, and then in February of this year, we suspended the enforcement of those penalties, relying on voluntary conservation, which has been pretty exceptional. Demand has been fairly consistent through that time period. You've twice had to extend the suspension of enforcement. The current suspension will terminate on Monday, the 31st. So at this point in time, we're asking you to look at extending it again through the end of the year to December 31st. There's a resolution in your packet, resolution 41-2016, that'll do that. Again, voluntary conservation has been outstanding, and it's staff's belief that the penalties are not necessary at this point in time. So I'd be glad to answer any questions.
Thank you. Board discussion, board questions? Director Barringer?
I didn't know. How long are we extending it for?
Till December, the end of December.
A two-month period.
End of December, then?
Yeah, I mean, I would recommend we go a little further, but you know that would be my recommendation. End of January or February, I think February would be a reasonable period of time. We're going to have rain, and we probably have rain. We could always bring it back earlier. We can always do that. But I would say till February 28th. That would be my recommendation.
Till the end of February?
Yes.
The end of February.
January,
okay.
February, that's a billing period. So I recommend that we approve item 9A with staff's recommendation, but extend it to February 28th.
Okay.
Second the motion.
Okay. It's been moved and seconded. Any further discussion on the motion?
Yeah.
Mr. Carmel?
I just wanted to say that if that's the direction, we'll go ahead and amend Section 1 of the resolution to extend it through February 28th, 2017.
Right, instead of every 2 months, as we've been doing.
It'll be a four-month period at this point.
Four-month period. And Director Rice?
I would just like to see it come back to the Conservation Committee to look at the actual numbers and to get down into the weeds so there can be a recommendation from the board that's based on data. And I would make that as a friendly amendment if that would be agreeable with Director Berenger and Director Sanders.
I will accept the friendly amendment that says that in the event we need to move it earlier than February 28th, that the Conservation Committee provide input to ask the General Manager to put it in earlier. But if the Conservation Committee looks at it and feels that it's not necessarily bring it back to the board, I'm just trying to save staff time and our time. Yeah.
And it's interesting because it was you and I, Director Rice, that were the conservation ad hoc a long time ago, if we remember. So I think we actually would almost need to activate that, and we can, so that if we do want to bring it back to the Conservation Committee, how is it that we could go about having Director Rice and I continue to serve in that role? It wasn't listed as one of our active ad hocs for this year. So we just want to go ahead and how would we do that? Just add it in?
No, I think it is active. Mm-hmm. Yes, Director Rice and I are members of it.
Okay. You're the members?
Yes.
Mm-hmm. So Director Sanders, would you
I would accept
the friendly amendment?
Absolutely.
Okay, good for the clarification. Okay. All right, very good.
And may I just make a suggestion that the end of our next billing cycle, that would be a good time for the Conservation Committee to convene, and then we can analyze that data. I think that's a really good point. And then if it looks like, oh, man, this is going south, then we can bring it back before that four-month period. If it's not, which we anticipate
we
it probably...
We might be able to make a recommendation to even extend it.
Yeah, you need billing
further.
Data. You're absolutely right. So we'll have billing data again when, Patrick?
We're waiting right now.
So... Okay, we're reading right now, so if it comes back and it's like, holy, you know what, we'll convene you guys. How does that sound?
Okay.
Sure.
Okay, so that's a condition that we can keep as an option. So then the motion, if you would repeat your motion, Director Bowringer.
I move that we take staff's recommendation on item 9B, extending the waiver of surcharges until the end of February, unless reviewed by the... Conservation Committee to bring it back earlier.
Second the motion.
Okay, it's been moved and seconded. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Aye. Opposed? Okay, passes again 5-0. So we're moving on now to item B. And so General Manager Gruber, if you would introduce item B.
Thank you, Madam President, board members. Item is discussion and consideration to authorize the application for fire grants. And William is here for this, but if you remember when the SAFER grant was applied for, the board had directed me to make sure that any future grants come back to the board. But you also gave me the authority to go ahead and preliminarily approve something. And so... With that, I did. When William sent me this, I said, absolutely, it's time sensitive. But we also did put it on the agenda because we want you to feel like you're and rightfully so, be a part of the process. So I don't want to take William's thunder, but it's for William, want to come up and tell a little bit about it? And I got it right here, but I think it would go a lot farther if you explained it. And just real quick, I appreciate... the fire department staff continuously going after funds for the community and for their department. I really appreciate that, William.
And Mr. Gruber, if I may, I also, you know, it's fine that these be applied for because we could always say we don't want them if we were receiving them. So we still are very much a part of the process.
Chief Hollingsworth.
I think now I'm on. Thank you for having me back for this, and the explanation, I believe, is entirely in front of you. I can offer a clarification on any issues. There's a handful of grants that we're looking at doing, and we're already doing the legwork on getting those prepared because, like General Manager Gruber suggested, they are time-sensitive. One of them is a number of them are actually regional grants. And we're taking the front load, the majority of the work on those, by hosting them. So a lot of the accounting and stuff like that is going to be falling on us, primarily Captain Torlano, and then Pat by association. And I don't know how much of that he's already bought off on, but I know that he's been extremely helpful in the past on making sure that the numbers match on everything we have to do because of the auditing process through AFG. Primarily, the regional grants we're looking at is personal protective equipment. Unfortunately, the cost of doing business is just, it escalates as time goes on. So turnouts, they have a lifespan. Wildland turnouts, they have a lifespan. They have to be replaced per NFPA code every 10 years. And so those things are not cheap, and it's real difficult to budget for those on a regular basis. So we're proposing to host a regional grant for that. We have five other agencies that have already signed up with us to participate. They include Atascadero, Paso Robles, Cayucas, Fort Hunter Liggett, and I think we're the other agency. Along with that, we're also looking at hosting a combination of, I'm going to call it an electronics grant for lack of a better term, but secondary to the ALS grant we got a few years ago, we got an EKG that we used for advanced life support services. That technology is already out of date, believe it or not, and we are looking at trying to get two brand new EKGs, one in the frontline apparatus and then one as a backup because it's always good to have both available to us. Those run approximately $35,000 a piece, and that would put us in concert with the same exact service delivery items that every other fire agency and ambulance ALS is using within the county. So interchangeability is very crucial there. And then radios fall into the same category. That's specifically these handheld style radios. These work very well for the community and where we are right now. However, anything we go on, like the chimney fire, for instance, or in mutual aid in other areas, we have to have the ability to do something called cloning. And that's the ability to take their programming and putting it on ours seamlessly so everybody can have open discussions and dialogue on the incident. And communications is always the number one thing that in the after action reports we talk about, boy, I wish we need to figure out how to do this better. And it doesn't matter, I've been doing this for 25 years, communication is still number one every single time. So the radios do need to be upgraded if possible. And then the final one is a prevention grant. And we're doing that in conjunction with the healthcare district to really try to approach the not just fire prevention, but then health, safety, fall prevention, a comprehensive approach to community education.
Okay, thank you very much. Do we have any discussion? Ready
I
for a motion?
I would move that we approve item 9B, but as part of the discussion, I think the issue was that we had an unintended consequence when we had a major grant going down the line. I'm confident that the general manager and our finance manager can put some, fuses in place or whatever to make sure we don't get too far down the line with a grant. But these kinds of grants, I think, should be administrative. And I think by approving this particular item, is with that said, is that if it looks like there is a major grant that the general manager or the finance manager raises a flag for matching funds that we just will never get, or other, especially ongoing employee costs, that they just bring it back there. So, I approve this, or my motion is to approve item 9B.
Second the motion.
Okay, it's been moved and seconded, and on discussion, if I may just add this, I believe what we're doing here is really what we had asked for from the prior grant that had kind of somehow just moved on. And so now I believe we're doing this with full board awareness and support so that you know you have certainly our approval, too, and support behind it. And so I think that's what we're trying to do. So it's sequentially, I think, a better sequence, of course, to start. Any further discussion, Director Rice?
I agree wholeheartedly with that, and especially with what Director Thompson said about being involved in the process and being informed. I have one just little question. On the regional PPE, there's a cost match, and it says that we're paying the entire regional match and getting reimbursement from other agencies. And the next one says that, that the CCHD is going to host that one, and therefore there's not going to be any cost. There's not going to be a reimbursement we're going to have to pay to them for that. I don't know if you, I don't know if you can answer that. I just wanted to make sure that it, it looks like.
To the best of my ability, yes.
Okay.
I believe what's happening is we are hosting all but the prevention grant.
Okay.
And the healthcare district is going to be hosting that, and that we're doing that in conjunction with each other.
Okay.
But Captain Torlano is doing the majority of the work for both of them. When we host it, we become financially responsible to pay the 5%. However, through memorandums of understanding and contracts that we will develop for the allied agencies that are participating, they have to pay us back their 5%. So we come out as zero is what it.
Okay, so it would probably work the same way with the CCHD, where
yes.
We would have to give. So there is a little minor cost to that on that one,
right? And really, what we're talking about
and
here
not,
is if they,
about
if
the
they,
same amount.
If for instance, Cayucas, just to use round numbers, if Cayucas Fire spent $100,000 on PPE,
uh-huh.
Their agency would have to come up with $5,000 for the purpose of hosting the grant. The services district will be paying their 5% to FEMA, or they will
right.
be just be responsible for it, not necessarily paying it to them, paying it to the vendors. But we will back bill Cayucas Fire for that $5,000, so we're not paying for what they're getting.
Gotcha. And I'm just saying on the CCHD
it would be the
grant,
other way
it would be the other way around.
Yes.
I just wanted to make sure that
if
I
that indeed
that.
Is the intent for
if
them
that's
to host
the,
it.
Right, if
yes.
that's the way, yeah, thank you very much.
Okay. Any further discussion? Okay, I think we're ready then for the question. On item 9B, all those in favor, say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? 5-0.
Please thank Captain Torlano for that work.
Yes, thank you very much. And yes, do tell Captain Torlano. We appreciate this. We're moving on then to item 11, future agenda items for any information we want prepared, other things that we think we want to see on a future agenda. Going once? Going? Yes, sir?
Mission Country's franchise extension, which will cover all those. And then also, I wanted to, we've informally have recognized pretty much everybody. I wanted to recognize the water and wastewater folks. I wanted to bring them here and tell them what a great job they're doing and have the board acknowledge that and the community acknowledge that. And they don't know that yet, so if they're watching this, they're probably. But I would like to do that. So we can talk about that later. But I'd like to bring those folks in and just publicly acknowledge them. So.
Okay. Now, just a point of clarification. When we're actually going to then, as a board, vote to put something on the future agenda, do we need a motion then, right? Or can the general manager and what he's just requested add those in?
The general manager has the authority to add items in. But if any individual board member wants something on the agenda,
yes. Coming from a board member, then we need to approve it. But from the general manager, that will be scheduled then in the near future. Director Rice?
We need to have something on the agenda about possibly raising the rates in January, right? The water and sewer rates? Or not raising them. We need to have something on the agenda.
No.
Don't we?
No.
It has to be approved by the board.
But you might not be on. We may not be on the board.
Yeah, I don't.
I don't think that that is
prudent. If the general manager sees the need, I'm sure he'll bring the matter back to us and put it on the agenda.
Mike, what do you think?
That's fine with me. I just want to make sure it's on the horizon. That's all. Because the increase couldn't go into place without approval of the board. And if we don't need to have the increase, I want to make sure that we've got that out there.
Oh,
too.
You're talking about the
4%.
But
yes.
That's not automatic. That doesn't have to happen in January. I don't think. Legal counsel?
Yes.
No, I think it's something that we could address. I don't think we're going to have to do that.
I hope we're not going to have to do it. I just think that it was something that.
And it could be less than that. So I think it requires the good deliberation of the entire board.
Exactly.
And possibly in January.
All right. All right. Going once, going twice. Thank you all. Meeting is adjourned.